Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. Americans have a funny way of dealing with death. Well, maybe not just Americans, but since that's who I've lived with most of my life, that's what I've got to go on. There are these phrases, for example. You find people using them in everyday speech as well as in more formal settings. He passed away, or he moved on, or sometimes it's just he passed, as if we're afraid to state the simple facts. I always put it right out there. He died. Whether I'm talking about someone I know, as in when my father died, or whether I'm talking about something in the future, when I die. It's always interesting to me how this makes some people feel uncomfortable. And I'm not talking about religion either. Religion has nothing to do with it. Whatever your beliefs, people, animals, creatures die, even if you believe they go on to some other world. In this world, the one that we experience every day, people die. Death has also become removed from us in other ways. We've professionalized it, hired it out, to hospitals, funeral homes. But it wasn't always like this. My parents' generation didn't do it this way. And I'm talking, you know, just 60 years ago. In their day, the family sat with the body in their home and received visitors. Now, many people are returning to this simpler, closer, more immediate way of dealing with death. They are foregoing funeral homes, the conventional methods, and taking matters into their own hands. And in this way, they're finding comfort. Today's program, produced by April Demboski, is called Death Comes Home.
It's Friday evening in Davis, California, a small city outside Sacramento. There's a huge harvest moon in the sky. In one suburban neighborhood, at the end of a cul-de-sac, is Joan Randall's house. It's a modest two-story home with a pickup truck in the driveway and two scarecrows in the front yard. Joan is rushing around inside, trying to keep herself busy. She looks like she's getting ready for dinner guests. But this is no dinner party.
I'm Joan Randall, and it's my ex-husband who has just died and who's lying in the other room in a beautiful pine box.
Joan and Mike had a rocky relationship. They were together, then they broke up. They were married, then they divorced. The last time they reconnected was 3 years ago, when Mike had a stroke.
Mike came back into my life after a long time of being gone. I saw him once in like a dozen years.
Joan agreed to care for him. Then Mike was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer a few months ago. She wasn't interested in any of the conventional funeral options. She wanted to bring Mike home.
When I thought about Mike's aloneness and isolation and dying in that state, the fact that I could bring him here, was very good.
Just before Mike died, she talked with him about a home funeral.
I talked to him and asked him, you know, had he given it any thought what happens after he dies? And he just points straight up, you know. And he made, you know, a poof sound. And I asked if he would hear what I would like to do. And so I went through it. He would die there. His body would come home here to my house and be here for 3 days, and people would be with him, talk to him, sing to him, play music, or ignore him. And he was just perfect. He was giving me all these signs of absolute perfect. And so then it was just like, boom, it was a go.
Joan realized she couldn't do everything on her own. She remembered a woman who helped with another home funeral.
My name is Heidi Boucher, and I am a natural death care provider. And I have been doing this for about, 25, 26, 27 years.
Heidi was drawn into this work by a family friend when she was a teenager. Today, she sees home funerals as a movement that might counter the American fear of death.
I think people are really wanting to have more say. We've seen people make choices as far as the food that they eat, the kind of cars they drive, where they send their children to school. Death is really the last frontier.
Heidi and Joan talked on the phone a few weeks before Mike died to work out the details. Then today, when Mike died in the nursing facility, they were ready to go.
She called me today around 4:15, 4:20. She said he had died. So I immediately gathered all my things together and stopped at the store and bought the ice.
Joan has cleared a spot in her small home office for Mike's casket. She pushed the file cabinets aside and moved the desk into a corner. Mike is undressed and laid out on a gurney along the open wall of the office.
So this is Mike, and we have just bathed him with rosemary water and have oiled him with rosemary. And as you can feel, he's still really, really warm.
Heidi dresses Mike in some clothes Joan has laid out for him. It's an outfit Mike would have worn to his tool shop.
We're putting on some, well, first he has some gray, just sports socks. And we have some light denim jeans. I don't know if they're Wrangler or Levi's. It's just a process of wiggling on, shifting. Most of us are connected to our clothing. You know, that favorite sweater, because I think it represents memories and feelings and good times. Or then you see somebody like me taking scissors to it and people just go, oh my God, I can't believe that's happening. I had one woman saw me cut her dear friend's beautiful dress. I said, that's the only way I can get it on. And she was horrified. So I just ripped up the back of the shirt. And now we're putting his arm in the sleeve.
Joan asked two of her friends to come help. They didn't know Mike and aren't sure how to be around him. So Heidi puts them to work.
So what we need to do is take the dry ice and we need to cut it into chunks. And I wrap it up in the one sheet like this. You're making like a little present. It's hot, cold, hot, cold.
The dry ice burns her hands as she tucks it around Mike's body.
The lady at the grocery store, you know, I always get, so are you going camping or having a party? And I never really know what to say, but it's always the same thing. And one day I just said, you know what? No, actually, somebody has died and it's da da da. And she looked at me and she just said, cool. That will be $49.32, and you know, ding, ding, ding.
For my own funeral, I would want people to be laughing and not crying.
I want a funeral that is as large as possible.
I think of what pictures I would want displayed near my casket.
I do not want to be at my own funeral.
I definitely want a home funeral.
A home funeral, if I had a nice home. You know, I wouldn't want one in my apartment.
All home funerals are different. There is no set formula for how events will unfold. Most often, rituals are made up in the moment as families deal with logistics and confront their loss. Jim Wheaton and Kirsten Prokopowicz both faced unexpected deaths. And they each found a way to say goodbye on their own terms.
My name is Jim Wheaton. 6 years ago, I was involved in a car accident in which my wife was killed. We were driving back actually from a Little League field right around dusk. And it was a narrow, winding two-lane road. And my wife was actually trying to sleep a little bit. She was tired. And had taken off her seatbelt because it was pinching on her neck. And then a deer leapt out, and I avoided it. I missed it, but then I hit a phone pole, and she went into the windshield. And I tried CPR, and it didn't work.
My name's Kirsten Prokopowicz. My beautiful husband, Brian Prokopach. About 7 o'clock, 7:15, I started just getting really panicked and was concerned and wanted to go pick him up. He was on his motorcycle, and I wanted to go and pick him up. I didn't want him driving home. And I got in the car and went and found him. I didn't find him. I found the accident. They wouldn't let me through. I just knew. I knew.
I made a couple of decisions. One is that at the time, my boy, our boy, was just 6, about to go on 7. And I decided that I would not, as my parents' generation did, hide anything from him. That death was not something that should be distant or happens away where people simply disappear and you never have any role in it. So I thought about it, and I decided that I wanted to make the coffin myself. Friend and I went over to the recycled lumber place, and I bought some really nice old oak that I think had been flooring someplace. And we went over to my shop. We put out word to friends, and probably 10 or a dozen people came over. And I taught people how to do woodworking, how to make finger joints for the corners, and you know, how to make a top and how to make it fit, and brought the boy over as well, got him out of school. And so together, he and I and a few friends made the coffin. And the friend said, well, let's just go back to your house and I'll have dinner. So we loaded the coffin in the back of the pickup truck and hauled it back over here to this house and put it right here in the living room where we're sitting right now. And all had dinner in the dining room. And so it's a little odd to have a coffin in your living room, especially when you know it's going to contain somebody you love the next day.
My son, he was 14 when his dad died. I came home and told him that his dad had been hit on a motorcycle and was dead. Oh, my God. Just no, and running around, no. Just shaking. We were both just shaking with each other. He was dead set against having his dad come back home. He couldn't see him. It was just too scary to see his dad dead. But I needed the closure. I needed to see him and be with him, and I wanted to touch him, touch his body.
Word went out during the dinner that anyone who wanted to bring something to put in the coffin to go with her could do so. And boy, people started to show up. And they brought flowers and photographs. People penned notes. Then we all sat in a big circle around the coffin in the living room. And each person put their item in and told a story, or not, as they chose, about what it was and why they were doing it and so forth. And again, the boy, Jesse, was amazing. He got up partway through, and people, of course, crying, and it's very upsetting. And he walked into the room and came back, and he brought back a box of Kleenex and started handing out Kleenex to people. And then when it was all over, we had this coffin full of stuff. And then he looked at me and said, Dad, where's my glue stick? And I said, glue stick? I don't know. It's probably up with your art stuff. He said, okay. He ran upstairs. Came back down and said, what do you need that for? He says, I want the pictures to be up. He didn't want the pictures to just cast in the bottom of the coffin. He wanted them up on the walls of the coffin so they could be seen. And so he very carefully sat there and he glue-sticked all of the photos to the sides of the coffin.
She says, if I leave before you, darling, don't you waste me in the ground. I lay smiling like a sleeping children. One of us will die inside these arms. Eyes wide open, naked as we came. One will spread our ashes round.
Hello? Yes. Mm-hmm. 4:20 yesterday afternoon, and I'm. If you want to come out of curiosity, I'm okay with that too. Okay, you know what I mean. I mean, not too many people do this. Uh huh. You just go to L Street.
Joan spends a lot of the vigil with her friends.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Bye.
People have come to visit and talk.
Okay.
Neighbors dropped off beef stroganoff and took the dog for a walk.
I just called my friend this morning and said, I'm changing the name of the cul-de-sac to Bates Place, and I'm keeping him.
Joan added some personal touches to the casket. She set up some candles, bear skulls from one of Mike's hunting trips, and a bottle of Jack Daniels. Joan also set Mike up with some essentials. She put a pack of cigarettes in his shirt pocket, and a lighter and a couple of bucks in his pants. Still, something was missing. His glasses.
I had to clean them first. That was also a thing with us. He'd come home from work, or he'd be wherever, and I'd look at his glasses. I said, how the hell can you see out of those glasses? It's like, you know, and then he'd just look at me, and I'd wash his glasses, sometimes with detergent. And so I washed them this morning before I put them on.
Joan leans on the casket as she talks. She says having Mike's body so close has made his death more real.
The first day I was busy doing. I got more emotional. Really did. And as time went on, I really wanted to spend more and more time with him. Surprised me. Oh, I played music. Rocked in the rocking chair, talked to him, pet his beard. Every time I passed him in the study, I just knocked on the lid every time I passed. I'd say something at the box.
Having Mike at home gave Joan a chance to get closure with him and also their relationship.
I couldn't imagine any other way ever again. You know, the animation is missing. And this was the vessel, and it needs to be disposed of, but there's not this quick toss out thing. And is that our guy?
Because Joan doesn't have a car large enough to hold a coffin, Heidi asked a funeral director to help transport the body. Joan sees the shiny white hearse pull into her driveway.
Here's your ride.
Heidi arrives, and several of Joan's friends gather to help carry the coffin.
Well, I'm gonna pass it down as we go.
They maneuver it through the door of the study.
Ready?
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Lift up.
Then carry it down the front steps to the car.
For a second.
Nice ride. I don't think he's done Cadillacs much. Kind of a Ford guy, Chevy guy. All right, bye, sweetie. Okay.
I know I want to be cremated and my ashes scattered into the ocean.
I think buried just because most of my family is Catholic.
Kind of like the idea of being put in a muslin sack and thrown in the ground.
I'll be cremated and I would like the ashes put in the compost.
I want to be planted in a forest and have an Oregon cherry put on my grave. And at my prime, I want to be cut down, and I would like to be made into bowls and spoons and musical instruments.
Some bright morning when this life is over,
Jim and Kirsten both decided to have their spouses cremated. Neither had a set framework of what to do with the ashes, so they both came up with their own rituals.
One of the reasons I didn't scatter her ashes is I thought, and I think I was right, that it is important to have a place that you go to, that you connect with the person. And for most people, I think that's a graveyard. And so what I ended up doing, I guess in the same spirit as building the coffin, I built the memorial. And we have a place up on a creek, a couple of acres in Redwoods and so forth, that meant a lot to us. While her ashes are there, that's less important than the fact that that's the place I go when I want to immerse myself in her.
I gathered up everyone, all his surf crew, and we went up to Brian's favorite surf cove. And as soon as we went to go scatter his ashes, the waves just started getting big and huge and just pounding on the beach. And then his friends took some of his ashes on the surfboard with all the flowers and paddled him out there to the waves and pushed him onto the wave.
I honestly don't know where all these ideas came from about having an altar or what to do with the ashes or building a memorial or building the coffin, for God's sakes. Why I pulled Jesse in and had him do everything. No, it's just improvising as you go along.
I think overall that Troy was happy that we had a home funeral. It was very hard for him to even... Friday, all he could do was walk into the room and walk out. Saturday, he sat in the room but really couldn't look at him. He'd look at him and then look away. By the end of Saturday night, he actually came in and wanted to hang out with his dad. So now he's like, okay, now I can hang with my dad.
It's always going to be a central fact in the rest of my life, no question. I mean, you can't be with somebody for 25 years, grow up with them, and then lose them suddenly and horribly in front of your eyes and not be affected. But it no longer is the defining thing about me. It's central but not defining. And it doesn't inform my every action anymore.
I think right now I'm in a state of being out of shock from it. And I'm more into this is a reality now, is that I am a widow.
It's Tuesday evening, a few hours after Mike was picked up from Joan's house. At 6:30, Joan and Heidi arrive at the crematory.
Oh, is that the door? That's Mike!
Ho! Ho!
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. Thanks.
My name's Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
NorCal Crematory, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
Come on over here. I understand that you want to push the buttons.
Yeah.
Joan decided to be as involved as possible in Mike's cremation. So Bill shows her how to operate the cremation chamber.
Turn that on. Press that. And then turn that on. You can hold your thumb on it and hold it. Don't let it go.
Right.
The door is going to raise up all the way to here. When it's up here and it won't go anymore, then you can let it go. I'm going to slide the casket into the retort. And then at that point, when it's all in, you'll hit the red button. It'll come all the way down. Okay?
See ya. It's been a pleasure.
Turn that one on and that one on.
Okay.
Right now the burner just came on and the flame is coming down on the casket and it's igniting it.
Joan and Heidi leave Bill behind to watch over the remaining 2 hours of the cremation.
Bye. Thank
Bye.
You.
Oh, Lord. Thank you, sir. That's my Jack Daniels I was going to drink.
Oh, can't forget that.
Thanks.
Joan gets home from the crematory and sits in her living room. The couches are still pushed to the wall to make room for guests. Dishes are piled up in the sink. And there's a stark gap along the wall of the study where Mike's casket no longer sits. Joan sips a glass of water and reflects on her experience of bringing Mike home.
there was something about him being here that kind of let me be in the moment of what this was and not kind of running around arranging things. So I haven't packed this stuff away. I think I'm in some ways I'm feeling free and, you know, freed up. I mean, freed, like lighter and because of that, it's almost like I can appreciate who he was better. Does that make sense? It enabled me to explore the depth of my feelings for him. Damn it. I'm really aware. Ooh, I'm really aware of the whole. Yeah. And it's he's not here. I can't pretend like he's going to wake up out of that beautiful pine box. I can't talk to him. I loved his hands. I can't look at his hands, stroke his hands. That was good to do that, even though he was dead in a doornail. So now I just have his empty boots and all that stuff. So now I'm gonna grieve. I don't know what happens on the other side. But my belief is that we are at least all one giant, we're all in one giant soup on one side or the other of life. And the more we can sweeten the soup, the better it is. And this was sweetening.
Death Comes Home was produced by April Demboski. Technical and editorial advisors were Claire Schoen and Cynthia Gorney. Music by Iron and Wine, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and Jillian Welch. If you missed part of this episode, or you'd like to hear it all again, you can do that on our website, soundprint.org. We archive all of our shows there and have links to additional information. On the next Soundprint, most things that go bump in the night may be imaginary, but that doesn't make them less terrifying. Hags and Nightmares, next week on Soundprint. CDs of Soundprint episodes are available for a small fee. Just call 1-888-38-TAPES, or you can order online at soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We'd like to know what you think. Your comments help us. Just send us an email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org. And don't forget to mention your local station. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrook. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.